time spent doing unbillable labor is usually a huge portion of the total time of every job. If you are not paying attention to it, it's kind of a silent killer. But when you do take a look at it and incorporate that as part of your overall growth, you can deliver a lot of efficiency and scale a lot faster. The mindsets that's been most successful amongst the contractors that we work with, the businesses that we've worked with, is to think of using software and AI to enable and empower each person to do 5 to 10 times more than they were doing previously, not to replace that person. And I think that's a way to deliver consistent, reliable, you know, safety compliant work, and then grow and scale your business.
The ideas that we talk about in this episode today are really only as good as your ability to implement them. If you're a growth-minded contractor who wants to systemize faster, our content, our coaches, and our community has you covered. Book a call with our team today in the link in the description. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Mark Wong, thanks for coming on the show, my friend.
Yeah, great to be here.
We are going to talk all things automation, AI, how to basically get rid of like admin bloat that happens in our contracting businesses. But I'm curious to chat with you about this because you're not from the contracting space. You've built a pretty epic piece of software that helps serve this space. And I've figured out a lot about where we waste time, effort, and money and energy when it comes to just the lack there of automation. So I'd love to even start with this. Like, you've come up through the world of software. Why did you end up focusing on the contractor space and our workflow of all things?
Yeah, I spent my career building software at companies like Microsoft and Facebook. I led teams that built Facebook's business management tools. It's used by most folks who advertise now. I was at Stripe, worked on systems processing billions of dollars of payments for companies like Lyft and Uber and DoorDash. My transition here was that I left my last tech job wanting to work on something that was more tied to the physical world. And I specifically wanted to focus on electrification and support the renewable energy adoption. And I founded Copperfield. It was a venture-backed startup. We built software specifically for electricians, and our focus is on technical calculations and permit paperwork, stuff that has to be right.
Sounds riveting.
And I think that... Go ahead.
Oh, I said sounds riveting. Sounds super exciting.
Yeah, for me, actually, I think it actually is.
I think so.
It's really opened my eyes to how much friction exists in the workflows. And I think the contrast between the level of support that a software kind of a worker has in a day-to-day job and what a contractor is typically get, even the leaders of contracting shops, it's night and day. So I think there's a massive opportunity to improve speed, accuracy, support, and help folks deliver better jobs for customers and also grow faster and make more money.
And this is, you know, for you, it's a business. It's a business model. Why is this so much a problem we're solving versus other industries? Is it just because we're more hands-on? Is it like there's more opportunity? We haven't solved a lot of this and other industries have. Like, what is it? What's the blue ocean here for you?
I think that one of the key things that's happening is that software is well known to be very powerful and solve a lot of issues. But I think it's really traditionally been tied to folks sitting at a desk where they have access and training to use computers very well. I think the thing that's really opening up now is that there's new, certainly everybody has a supercomputer in their pocket, and there's new interfaces, new abilities for software to listen to voices, to look at through the camera, look at what's happening in the real world. And so now you're seeing that software can be delivered in a way that doesn't require a ton of traditional software training, doesn't require a lot of experience with sort of desktop software, and actually can deliver amazing results in the field on the job. And so that's really why I think there's kind of a renaissance in software being built for contractors and folks who do things, important things in the real world.
It's getting a pair of eyes and ears, and it's becoming more tactile than it used to be. And so now it can make its way into the physical world. And that makes a lot of sense. What would you say with the contractors you work with the customers that you've served over the years, what are the biggest blind spots that we have where we just assume this is how it has to be done? And you're like, no, here's where a ton of wastage exists.
Yeah, I think the thing that we've seen a lot, and so just for some context here, we've now had the opportunity to work with many thousands of contractors in every state in the country, specifically electricians in our case, but I think the lessons and learnings are pretty applicable across the industry, that there's a real focus on growing the top line. I think the top line is always sexy and attractive, you know, new leads, new jobs, new capabilities, new partners. And I think efficiency often takes a back seat, but it's a huge part of the solution. Another analogy here is like focusing on lifting weights while ignoring diet and sleep. So like they're parts of the solution. And if you sit down and actually count the hours, time spent doing unbillable labor is usually a huge portion of the total time of every job. And so it's the thing that if you are not paying attention to it, it's kind of a silent killer. But when you do take a look at it and incorporate that as part of your overall growth, you can deliver a lot of efficiency and scale a lot faster.
How much is that? If you were to try and quantify just a rough average, but how much are we doing non-billable hours with billable employees in say the HVAC electrical space?
Yeah, I can give. I'll start with an example and kind of sure. summarize what we've seen so far. So the most common job that we see or that our customers are doing is something like a EV charger installation. So for an electrician, go to a customer's house and put in a new EV charger. That's often about a 2 hours billable job in terms of time spent hands on and the materials. And then one particular process they have to do in order to do this is to get a permit. And so that's like a 30 or 40 minutes of work, typically using pen and paper or like a spreadsheet template that they get from a jurisdiction. And they often have to do it when they're back in the office. So you can imagine somebody's at somebody's house. They've got to take some prep photos, go back to the office, spend 30 or 40 minutes to get this thing done. And now contrast that with software. They can get this thing done 3 minutes from their phone in the customer's home from a photo of the panel and then a quick sanity check. And they're done. So on a 2 hour job, you're looking at this just one case, half an hour is a 25% reduction in the total time. And for a shop with multiple crews doing multiple installs a day, the efficiency really compounds. And that's just this one task. And typically there's multiple tasks like this that eat time and unbillable labor. So overall, we're typically seeing somewhere between 35 and 45% of the total time spent on every job is in this sort of silent, unbillable work that can be optimized.
The paperwork side. The actual like
on the paper side.
On the back end. So let's look at this industry as a whole, but like if we were to look at the workflow of a contractor, everything from lead generation to scheduled of an invoice, give me some specifics. Where are our biggest opportunities to just cut back on some of this waste? We just talked about one, which is like actually getting, you know, our numbers correct after we kind of go to a job. Can you walk me through, if we look at the workflow, where are the biggest opportunities to save time?
Yeah, I think one framework that can be pretty helpful when you're doing this kind of an audit of looking at where there's waste. There's a system that the Toyota put together called the Toyota Production System, and I think there's a framework that's really helpful to identify the types of waste. And so I'll just kind of share what they identified. You're looking for defects, overproduction. You're looking for waiting, unutilized talent, waste in moving things around. Waste in inventory, waste in motion, so moving too much, and over processing. And now, of course, this is a bit rigid, and you kind of look at, you can look at everything that's happening in your day to day. But typically, you know, the way to figure out where the waste is to have high visibility into what people are actually doing, and then a real understanding of how these jobs go, plus systems that make it easy for the folks who are in the field to share data back to you and then to raise concerns or suggestions. I think that's kind of the overall look to try to understand where the waste is in each business. It's typically falling into this sort of paperwork, unbillable labor category, but you know, to really understand what it is, the visibility and systems to support visibility is what really helps.
So let's talk practical. So I'm running an electrical business. I'm installing EV chargers, and I've heard about you and what you can do to help me. But I, as an owner, have to go and identify this myself. What am I physically doing on Tuesday with my crews to start identifying these gaps?
Yeah, the quickest and easiest way to get started that we've seen is to actually do the ride-alongs. Just to go with the crew, choose a job or choose a couple of jobs, try to do it regularly. The thing that's super important about the ride along is to resist the temptation to teach or correct, change behavior, and really restrict yourself to watching and observing, taking notes. That's where you'll be able to see and understand where the opportunity is. And then you can support this if you have more time to invest. Kind of depends how busy you are and kind of the if you can invest more into systems, like for example, time trackers, or we've learned a lot from a customer that's out in the East Coast. They're a multi-state contractor with about 300 technicians. They use systems for software where the folks are actually logging when every kind of activity in a job is happening. So they're able to collect the data through the activities that the technician wants to do. So they need to check in, you know, like timesheets and time tracking and so forth. But it also feeds into this ability for them to know exactly where folks are spending time. But the first thing that's easy and quick is to do the ride along, just watch and observe. And then you can get more sophisticated depending on how much time you want to invest into it and what, you know, how obvious the areas of opportunity are.
And I would imagine, like, if I've built this business and I built even the process that my team's using, I've got my own bias about like, yeah, this is how we do it. This is how it needs to be done. Is it as simple as just logging what's billable versus non-billable? Because otherwise I've got my own bias about this being a productive thing we do because we've always done it this way. Like, how do I get rid of my bias in this?
Yeah. I think one of the really important things and sort of a way to improve the outcome here is to check in with what folks are actively already kind of looking for. And so you'll have your bias, you'll observe, you'll see what folks are doing. You'll have an opinion about what you think should be faster or slower. But you also should check in to see if there's tools. Like one specific thing that you could do is to look and ask folks whether they've been searching, whether they've been Googling for specific tools or specific solutions for portions of the job. Or you should also look for areas of the job where you might have a process in place that's being skipped or not done well. And so even though your opinion is that, you know, hey, this person is just not doing a good job, I think one kind of rule of thumb here is to bias yourself to blame the process as the default, as opposed to the training of the worker, and then look at that process and try to improve it and make sure that the standards are clear, and then identify whether that process is repeatable, should be automated, can be eliminated, and all the things that you could kind of do around it. And then look for specific solutions for the ones that take a lot of time.
Okay. You mentioned people. How do I decipher between what is a people problem and what is a workflow problem?
Yeah, this is a really good question, and it is difficult. Getting an intuition of what is a people process, what is a people problem versus what is a sort of support and tooling problem, and then getting an intuition of which tools are going to be able to actually help you. That's also challenging. I think the bias towards the issue being in the workflow is very helpful, and then also the clarity of standards. Like, is it very clear to the person who's doing the work what your expectations are of doing that work? If they're not able to meet those very clear expectations, then obviously it is a skill or a training gap. But assuming they are able to perform the work up to your expectations, then the first port of call is definitely in figuring out how to support and improve the system around the work that they're doing.
And I guess we're kind of almost assuming this, but at some level you have to have a documented workflow to start with. You have to have, this is how it actually should be done. Now we can determine whether you're following process or not. And then from there, if you are, we can go to the final thought, which is, hey, this workflow needs to be updated.
Yeah. And I think it doesn't have to be like a beautiful workflow diagram that's huge and it's on the wall. But I think that there, that if you have observation into, for example, you do these ride-alongs, you can take your own notes of the process that typically happens during the ride-along. That is definitely enough. It's sufficient to get a sense of what the flow is usually, what it looks like. And of course, you'll have a sense of which crews are the best or performing the best. And then comparing the differences between what the best crew is doing and what other folks are doing is going to give you a good sense of it as well. So it doesn't need to be formal. You don't need to go hire a consultant to go and do like a workflow map or anything like that. I think that kind of hands-on observation and then just repeating it and making sure that folks are able to kind of see as things evolve is the key.
And what are signs that something's ready to be automated? Because I would imagine there's so many things we could do. How do you pick the one or two things that you want to fix? I mean, even for you, like, how did you pick the solutions you wanted to solve with the software you guys created versus all the other things you could do?
Yeah, I think for us as a we're a bit fortunate in that we provided at the beginning of kind of what Copperfield was doing, we were providing end-to-end solutions for electricians who were selling EV charger jobs in particular. And so we got very clear feedback from our customers as to which portions of the software they most valued. We could see that they were using it, they were asking about it the most, they were asking for features the most. And that kind of gives us this broad view across all the different actions. I think for a more general take on how to identify the areas of opportunity, it's really looking for work that's repeated across jobs. But I think a key sort of improvement in how to look at this is the size of that repeated job. And so we've heard a lot of feedback from shops who are really looking for a single solution to kind of automate the workflow that they are looking at across their whole company.
We've seen
that often that doesn't work because most companies are unique. They have unique workflows, and also it requires a lot of training to implement any kind of new system across the entire company at the same time. So what we've seen successful for the folks that we're working with is that they're finding pockets of repeatable work, even if the jobs are different. And so that's, I think, like what we're working on in particular around electrical permit paperwork, load calculations is a good example. That is something that is a small task and it's a part of many jobs. It's not automating all the jobs in a single system, but it's really repeatable. And there is a very clear standard for what needs to be produced. So that's a good candidate. It takes enough time. It's a significant contributor to the non-billable time, and it's repeated across jobs. And so, I think that's what the learning that we'd want to share with other folks as well, is to find portions of jobs and not try to kind of boil the ocean and automate the whole thing in a single shot. And then I think we might touch on this a bit later. Is actually a very useful kind of property or tool of AI to help orchestrate between different software tools. The exact feedback we heard is, we just want one software. We've got too much software. We want one software to go do this. And I think that that really hasn't panned out for a lot of the folks that we work with. It's going to be a solution of multiple pieces of software strung together by internal process and then assisted with AI to move data back and forth between things.
It's interesting you bring that up because a lot of our members are like, isn't there just one tool? Why do I have to have 700? Can you just give me one and it'll just be one place where I can go for all things? And you're saying, hey, it actually shouldn't. If you do that, you're going to block out all your other opportunities and workflow and just try and solve one thing and miss the bigger picture of where you could be more of a surgeon to fix issues.
Yeah, I think we've seen that every shop needs to have a system of record of some sort. So a system should be selected where things are kind of centralized and there's some order to the chaos. But I think what we've seen is that it's not necessary to fully standardize 100% of these processes. And actually, the desire to do that slows down adoption and reduces your potential for automation.
One thing we're working actually even internally in our team is we don't have a good baseline to hold all of our data. And so we have to build that database ourselves, and then we have to have it open API with all the tools so we can plug a tool in and out and have it replaceable as we evolve and as the world evolves and technology evolves, that we can have that plugged in and out without so much chaos. But if all those tools hold their own little bits of data and you have no central place for it all, every time you have to do a full system revamp and it just creates chaos. So is this the right way to build the data infrastructure? We're getting a little nerdy now, but I'm just curious, like to build data infrastructure, it's like have one database and then have tools that you plug in and out of that one database. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So from learnings, I guess, from the software building and the tech industry, the key thing is the customer's experience. And that's always the thing to follow. Jeff Bezos famously says, like, everything is all about customer experience. That's the only thing that matters. So I think following from that philosophy, the most important thing to standardize is the customer relationship management and understanding what the customer's experience is going to be, what those touch points are. Internal stuff can be messy, and that's fine. Even at the largest companies in the world, the internal stuff is always messy. It's really figuring out and making sure that you're presenting your best face to the customer. And then, kind of as I mentioned, on a little bit more on the nerdy side, AI is actually fantastic at finding ways to orchestrate data across different tools, moving data from back and forth, slightly more traditional tools like Zapier, super useful for connecting different software together. And then just next level in terms of connection in the capabilities of something like Claude or OpenAI. But I think that there's an anxiety almost around adopting these systems and like trying to figure out what's going to be useful. Even for us, like we're always reading on Twitter the latest cool doodad that's going to connect things and just run the business by itself. And there's some reality to that, but there's also a lot of kind of bluster. And I think that
marketing, really we call it marketing
experience. Focusing on the customer experience, getting that clean, and then trying to use tools as necessary to string things together is usually the most efficient way to kind of improve the processes. And so you've identified what's going on, you know the areas that you're looking for, you've kind of sussed out some reasonable solutions, you find a solution that solves the specific problem that's repeatable across jobs, and then you kind of orchestrate, okay, how do I make sure that the data is not duplicated, or that the kind of we're not kind of chasing things around or losing stuff.
Okay. And I wrote some notes too while you're saying this, but like, it's the things that are high time consumption and in almost all of our jobs. It's like, this thing seems to show up, even though we have tons of different types of jobs, here's a process that happens in almost every single time. And it takes a decent amount of, you know, like physical time in the day. That's the where I want to kind of start.
Or mental burn. I think I can share a specific example that was, I thought, kind of eye-opening for when we were really active in doing EV charger installations. So customers are always annoyed that people are not showing up on time, or they don't know when people are going to show up. And so, like, as an example of a task that is repeated across every job, even though it individually didn't take that much time, as a very powerful automation, is to get something that automatically text messages the customer when the technician is en route to the person's house. And so the technician, you know, they need to know where to go anyway. So like, a great integration point is like, when they go and find the address of the next job, they tap the button, it sends the text message, the customer knows when the person's going to show up. The customer experience is improved. That's key. And then you've also got a great entry point for other stuff, which is it's easier for the technician. You have the data for when they're showing up for the job. It's going to integrate in, for example, into timesheets and time tracking. And it just starts the flow. And it's just like a small thing, small optimization, but it's powerful and it's good for the customer.
Right. And it's mindless for the person. They don't even know what's happening, but it solves that problem for them. And like you said, actually, it's interesting. The other big note I took from you is everything is based on the customer experience first. It's like, build that out and then everything will serve that one ideal.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think that's where you're going to get the most bang for your buck.
Where do we over automate? Where do things need to stay human longer? And I remember when I was prepping for you, you said one of the biggest parts, hardest parts of building your software was, hey, the thing about using AI to come up with decisions is it can't be 90% accurate. It has to be 100% accurate. Otherwise, even if it's off by 10%, it causes massive mistrust. You have to constantly check your own system. So where is that existing now? Like, where do we still need to keep the human in the loop, per se, and make sure that we don't over-automate too quickly?
Yeah, I think from what we've seen, folks in the contracting world are doing critical, you know, safety critical changes in the physical environments. Like, these are things that need to be right. They need to be done well the first time. And I think there's a fundamental mismatch in how AI does things, which is sounds extremely confident 100% of the time and is right maybe 70 or 80% of the time. And so this is it's a tricky thing to figure out where really to apply AI to processes. I think it's helpful to think about where AI came from and, you know, what it's trained on. AI is trained on the internet, and it's basically consumed all the content on the internet, and then it's good at the things that the internet generally is good at. And so the top thing that it's great at is communication. It's written communication, is fantastic at written communication. It really understands how to the nuance and writing. And so I think the strongest suit right now for AI is improving the way that you can communicate with your customer, improving the way that you're communicating within your team. It's fantastic. And then when you kind of get into things that are, like you said, need high degrees of reliability or repeatability, AI is typically a great assistant, but not it is not the solution. And I think the mindsets that's been most successful amongst the contractors that we've worked with, the businesses that we've worked with, is to think of using software and AI to enable and empower each person to do 5 to 10 times more than they were doing previously, not to replace that person. And obviously, the person, there's a shift in terms of the hiring, in terms of what folks are looking for, you know, the ability to learn tools, curiosity about technology, all super important. But fundamentally, these businesses are investing and they're thinking of AI and software as an investment into a great team to augment them, as opposed to a way to replace them. And I think that's a way to deliver consistent, reliable, you know, safety compliant work, and then grow and scale your business.
Can you give me like a specific example of what you mean by that? So like what that would look like in something where I'm using, say, your software to do this. I'm checking the work, I would assume. Like, walk me through what this looks like where the human's involved, but they're saving that person a ton of time. They could be 5 times more effective.
I think I can give you a pretty clear example. So one of the tasks that's sort of specific to the electrical field is that they need to do something called a panel schedule. So that's if you're replacing someone's electrical service, they need to go and basically copy all the labels that are on the breakers of an electrical circuit board. You need to put it onto a sheet, and then you need to have these things labeled with the breaker amperage. So it's a ton of time in terms of data entry, and it's very finicky to kind of do. So this is an example where a software can be really helpful in assisting the person who's on site get it done quickly. So for example, our software, you take a picture of the panel. We use AI to machine read the text on it, and then it inputs into a sheet. But crucially, it doesn't just output this as the answer. It gives you what it's read, and it gives the person who's there the opportunity to review easily and correct the things that need to be corrected, making sure everything is right. And so if you're looking for software that really is has this kind of bias for folks to make it easy for the things that machines are good at, but review and then sign off on the final output so that you feel confident, the operator feels confident, the technician feels confident that the result is correct, but you've cut out 80 or 90% of the time that is in there.
Right. So you're like, here's from one photo, I want you to go do a 1 hour job in 30 seconds. Thank you for doing that job. Problem is, I don't fully trust you. So I need to now apply critical human thinking to the final check mark, basically. And once that's done, we can move the process forward. And it's building things in that way where it's like, we're going to let you do the job, but then we're going to not fully trust you, check your work, and then check off with a human, move forward.
Yeah. So I think it's very similar with what folks are kind of learning on the AI. It's about providing workflows where they can assist, but the human remains in control. And then this, you know, as things get more sophisticated, the steps that it's doing are going to grow as well. But that's sort of fundamentally the mentality that's been successful for folks in the field is to empower that person to do more and get more done and be more efficient. And you have the sort of trust in that person as the person on site who's going to make sure that the customer is getting a good output.
And how much more accurate is it getting? Like, given last year versus this year versus what you might think will come in a year or two from now, is it getting increasingly more accurate, or is it hitting a bit of diminishing returns where it gets to an 80% accuracy rate and it starts to kind of level off?
Yeah, I think as a technologist, it's a very exciting time to be building, in that it is improving. The sophistication of what it can do is definitely improving, but it comes in domains, and it really goes back to where it's getting data from. And so if you're looking at AI, there's enormous gains in how well it can understand and create code. There's a ton of data. It's very easy for it to train. And so those improvements, and there's a lot of people who are very active and also sharing a lot. So this is, you know, how the sausage is made. When you have software, there's a lot of folks who are willing to share the outputs of what they do. And so it learns, and the cycle moves really fast. What's interesting is that in the physical world, that doesn't really exist. And so the level of sophistication and the speed of improvement for AI in physical tasks or in assisting with physical tasks is generally a bit slower. So I think there's something to kind of look for and try to understand the inherent strengths of AI. And then I think it's the job of companies like Copperfield or other folks who are building software for contractors is to figure out how best to match the strengths of AI to a workflow that actually makes sense and produces consistent and reliable outputs for the customer and for the person using the software.
That makes sense. I think we've already covered this, but like, is there any other just like best practices when it comes to what we're talking about, which is kind of like balancing automation with human critical thinking? How do we do this right so that our teams don't just turn their brain off and be like, yeah, it looks about right. Check.
Yeah. I think there's some things that are kind of nice, good properties of the way that things have been set up. And I think this has sort of been true for a really long time, in that there's a license holder typically in a lot of contracting businesses. And the license holder is the person who has to sign off and say that, yes, like to the best of my knowledge and my professional standards, this work is going to be compliant. And I think that that has a lot of weight in making sure that, you know,
You're still holding accountability on the person. At the end of the day,
there's this accountability.
It's
from
signature.
That accountability will flow, you know, back to kind of what we were chatting about before, the need to ensure that work is checked and that there's systems in place for the quality to be there. And that hasn't really changed. And I think actually most contracting businesses are really good at upholding a high quality bar, delivering great work to the customer. So it's really just about trying to figure out, okay, now as we rely more on software to do portions of this job, how do we make sure that quality continues to be good? And then to use the systems that are available now to sample and review digital work in addition to physical work. So, you know, since the beginning of trades, it'd be necessary to figure out how to train an apprentice to do a good job and then to make sure that they continue to do a good job. So now that's a little bit more like that's a portion, but the digital tools and the work need to be evaluated as well to make sure they continue to do a good job for you.
Let's talk a bit about adoption, because what I'm talking about and you're talking about right now is going to be brand new and is probably brand new for most of your customers. How do you get adoption from your team? Where does it go off really well? Where does it become very sluggish? Where do you see human resistance when it comes to this time to change?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think this is it's been a tricky issue for a lot of folks as to how to push out these kind of changes. The thing that's, you know, starting from the beginning of picking and choosing which things to automate, a really helpful kind of tailwind for adoption is if folks in the field or the folks who are using the software were already asking or looking for a solution. And so it's much, much easier when they're, you know, from the folks who are going to be the users of that are already kind of looking for a solution. And I'll contrast this with a thing that we've also seen, which is that, you know, tops down, the boss has a great idea about what is going to happen, and then kind of pushing it out into the organization. There's obviously going to be a combination of both of these things, but it really does help if there's at least a couple of folks, champions within the team, who are already seeking a solution or are going to be kind of the leaders in implementing that and then showing people what the new way is or the method and kind of driving it from there. And then the other portion of this is to try to find software that is relatively easy to use and doesn't require a ton of new adaptation. And this is also getting back to the decision that every business needs to make as to like how much to take on at the same time. Mm-hmm. When there's smaller chunks of functionality, when things are more specific, it's a lot easier for those things to get adopted than if there's a wholesale change in how the company needs to operate. So especially what we've seen is if there's change that needs to be adopted across disciplines or across teams, that really bogs down the process. So, for example, if you've got technicians in the field need to do a thing that's different, but also accounting needs to do a thing that's different and sales needs to do a thing that's different at the same time, that really complicates the deployment. It turns it into like a company level thing. Whereas if you have something that's just within a single team, the team leader can just say, here's the new tool. Hopefully you've got an advocate in the team. They can show people how it saves some time. It's relatively easy to use. Then from there, we've seen that adoption actually happens very quickly, because once people see they don't need to spend a bunch of time doing something that's not super valuable to them personally, or they can do more jobs, that's going to be something that they do. And then if it's really working well, they're going to tell their friends about it as well.
I can see how this would be frustrating for the entrepreneur, because like we often have a vision for how things could be and we're like, oh, I can see it from soup to nuts, from the beginning to the end, how it all looks, right? And you just like, you want to write it all down and then you want to put it all in place. And if you only put a part of it in place, it doesn't feel like you've really done it justice. Like, you know, I have a vision that I want to create still. But what you're saying is like, sure, write it all out all you want, but then pick the biggest opportunity that the thing is the most time consuming and is a part of most parts of the job, and then narrow in on that one thing. Pick one tool, use it based on what your team is already asking for, so there's already automatic buy-in, and just move slowly, one element at a time.
Yeah, I think this is probably my most experience, or where I would draw the most experience from this is rolling out change in a big organization, like something like a Facebook, I thought was very helpful. And it's just kind of matching the change that you want to make to a cadence that makes sense. And so for the day-to-day stuff, you want this small adoption, right? You want small changes that can be very quickly, easily adopted. You got a fast cycle. If it works, fantastic. If it doesn't work, you can discard it and try something new. But then there's going to be bigger stuff that you want to change. Like you really want to change the way that your business operates, or you've got this vision for how things work, or you want to implement some new and really innovative way to serve the customer that none of your competitors are doing. So those things also are important, but you just have to choose a time scale for them. You don't do those every week. You got to choose a time for them, and then you do the kind of planning and preparation for them. And then you try to bundle in the learnings that you've had from these faster iteration cycles into those larger changes, so that when you're rolling them out, you know, you're getting the best of both worlds and not tying yourself only to small changes, but also not sort of pushing the rock up the hill all the time, trying to get massive change that your team actually forgets, you know, which parts of the process to go and do.
This has been a lesson I've had to learn over the years, man. Because when we were in year one, we could make big change overnight and nobody cared because there wasn't much of a process and there wasn't many people involved. And as the business got bigger and things got more cemented in, making change felt harder, more expensive, more time consuming. And me, I felt like we could just bust through it through like just pure, you know, everyone calls me a bull in a china shop. It's like, let's just break it and do it again. And my business partner is the voice of reason, right? He's the implementer being like, no, slow iteration over time at this point. And it's a mindset shift. It's like, I cannot make all the change that I see in my brain. I have to be patient. And I have to, like you just said, kind of guess and test slowly along the way. Otherwise I'll create more chaos than good. So
yeah, no, there's tons of interesting stuff in there. A behemoth like Microsoft, for example, it's just incredibly difficult across 100,000 people to change things all at the same time. But there's a lot of, I think the software world, you know, there's pros and cons for how software world operates, but there's been a lot of interesting push in the management of the software kind of companies that I think is really interesting in terms of flattening, reducing layers, trying to reduce the amount of change management that has to happen. But ultimately, you still have to pick a cadence between these things. But I think that there's, you know, we probably don't have a full amount of time to discuss it, but lots of interesting things, especially with AI as well, that reduce that have this potential to reduce the amount of layers between folks, and then are also on the software side kind of compressing the number of different roles that need to be available at the company. So like, as a specific example, traditionally there would be someone who just tests software, someone who develops and writes the code, someone who specifies the software. And increasingly, you see that those are becoming the same person. Mm. That it's just a person with tools that enable them to be very fast and effective at doing all of those aspects of the job. And then that iteration cycle is inherently much quicker, because instead of three people agreeing, you've got one person who can try the thing three times. And so you have three shots at the thing as opposed to kind of a long, long discussion. So finding ways to do that in the business to reduce the number of channels that have to agree is always super valuable, and something that I found super useful in my own career and also just inherently easier as the companies get smaller.
Well, let's talk about change management for a second, because I think at some level you've got, like you said, a couple thousand customers you work with right now, and I'm sure you see the spectrum, everyone from this is a complete dumpster fire and I can't make change management this person at all, to this is the ideal customer to work with and they're doing a great job adopting this thing and bringing it into their teams. What's the difference? What's some of the best practices that someone listening right now could be like, right, that is how I'll bring proper change management? Because yeah, technology is overwhelming, man. There's so much change happening. You open up your YouTube feed and suddenly see seven new things happening in your industry tomorrow. How do we as owners adopt and change to this changing world, but in a healthy way based on some of the examples you've seen out there?
Yeah, I think there's two archetypes that I think we've seen across our customer base. For us as a tool that serves generally, you know, small to medium sized businesses, the most successful archetype is the kind of motivated, technology curious person. And so that's the person that is looking and sort of has their eyes open for new tools or processes that they've seen or heard of, and that they can become the internal champions within the company. And that adoption just follows because they're more productive. They're kind of open to sharing within their company, and that adoption just follows. The other shape that we've seen that's also successful is this kind of commitment within the organization to improving the process. So like as a specific name, like a quality department or a quality division, or like a, you know, it might be like some kind of a titles or names that follow the sort of leadership model. And they're defining the standard of what the company needs to do in order to deliver a great customer experience. And so they're kind of like a champions of the customer experience, of the quality of the output. And then they are empowered to set up the kind of tools and structures and expectations of what everybody needs to follow. That's really useful for a large organization. For the smaller organizations, it's really about the finding those people who are curious and who are naturally going to be experimenting with different things that drive the adoption across the the business and in whatever that they're trying to do.
Well, you said something very relevant, I think, even for a small business, is if I'm hiring, right, and I'm wanting to bring in a new project manager, I could hire somebody with a ton of project management experience. Maybe they've been doing it for 25 years and, you know, they know the gig. Or I could be looking for someone that's a bit more forward thinking and a bit more excited about what's coming and a bit more innovative. And maybe they don't have as much project management experience. Maybe it's only 5 years, but they're all about what's coming. And if I'm to make a hiring decision between these two, I might be hiring the more forward thinking person because I know I need to create change management in that area. And it's not just going to come from me as the owner just wanting it to happen. It's going to come from that champion that really cares and is aspiring. Is that a good way to kind of put it?
That's definitely what I'm seeing. It's what we're doing at Copperfield. What I've seen at these innovative tech companies that I've worked at is that it really is about a person who is driven and is curious and is open to what is out there that drives the best and fastest change, especially as these tools, especially in the software world, get better. I think in the contracting world, you have to balance this with the core and key skill of delivering what is a difficult technical job that has to be done. So that, of course, is the has to be there as well. But I do see that the shift in terms of the importance of this open-mindedness, this ability to learn, is now higher than it was previously. And so your overall, you know, in your organization, as you think about designing who you're bringing in, you should at least have a couple of folks on the team that have this really strong bias to being curious and learning and understanding new tools, because it's going to help your overall organization stay in touch and then evolve a lot more quickly.
And arguably is 10 times more important than it was 5 years ago, right? Which was before kind of a nice thing to have. Now it's becoming almost mandatory to have. The other thing
I can give a specific example. We're looking, you know, we've been looking for someone to help us with our growth, and we're trying to figure out what a good assignment might be, for example, or like a kind of screening assignment for this thing. And old example would be to go and design a landing page, you know, to launch a digital marketing campaign. Mm-hmm. And then now with the modern tools, that is a 1 minute task. You just talk to your phone and say, I want a landing page to do something. And it just will make you a landing page. So it's no longer sufficient as to even evaluate a person, because they can just get that done. You know, they might even be like brushing their teeth or something when that's happening. So it's trying to figure out, what is that mindset? Can they learn? Can they shift and adapt with the tools? Will they be helping to bring your organization into the future using what's available? And then from the management perspective, for the owners, trying to match those folks and give them the voice that you need to give them to hear their feedback, you know, to do those ride-alongs or to do that observation, and then really understand what they're looking for, you know, understand what they're searching for, to drive the match between the vision of what you've got for the company, as well as what folks on the ground are kind of seeing on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, it's less about just looking at like, what have you done, but it's looking at how you have gone about doing it. How did you go about problem solving? How did you go about thinking through that? How did you go about coming to that conclusion? The solution better be good on both cases, but I care more about how you went about it.
Yeah, for future growth, for sure.
The other thing you said about customer experience, I don't disagree with. Even a small company, like if I can hire somebody, let's call them in the office and be like, this person isn't just good at taking care of details and keep making sure everything's in the right place. They're obsessed about my customer experience. And that's somebody who's going to drive innovation on the overall workflow as well, which could be easy to miss, because I could hire somebody that's just really good at QuickBooks and really good at, you know, reconciling things and really good at keeping everything clean. But I could also hire somebody who's just obsessed about improving the customer experience that also tends to do those things. And they will, through osmosis, improve the overall workflow.
Yeah. This specific example from the world of Copperfield is, you know, we produce this technical output. It's a load calculation. It complies with the NEC code. But you see the organizations that are really forward on customer experience, turning this output, because we have an output now that looks nicer, is professional, and then finding ways to share that with the customer, even at the sales process, even at the very beginning of the sales process, to show the depth and the quality of the process that this company is going to go through and going to deliver you the best work. And so I thought it was really neat to see, you know, we typically think of this as kind of a back office process. You got to go and do this permit paperwork, but the best companies are taking that. They do a great job of it. And then they're presenting it to the customer as part of the overall package to just show, this is the level of quality and detail that we're going to go through in every aspect of the job. And they're going to win more jobs and they're going to be more successful.
Very cool. One final thought on this. We go and we do all this work. We identify where our holes are. We start to identify one key area we make the biggest time improvement. How do we measure and review this over time to make sure it's actually making an impact and not just adding more complexity to an already complex way of doing things?
Yeah, I think the sort of visibility we talked about quite a few times, having visibility and repeatability in the process is going to be critical for you to figure out if things are actually working. Customer, you know, feedback from your customers, feedback from your staff is definitely interesting. I think where this is going to be likely challenging for everybody is to figure out the total sort of return on investment from a business owner perspective, as especially as you've got multiple pieces of software kind of floating. And I think on that one, there's going to be there's a lot of a judgment call. And I think using software again to try to figure out across these different tools how much you're paying for them, you know, how much they're helping, and then trying to assess which ones you want to keep, which ones you want to cut, it's going to be an important function for the overall management of the business. And so that that cost kind of aspect can be a challenging one to look across the business. But overall, of course, the bottom line is what really matters. But I think incorporating the feedback from customers as well as from the staff who are using it as to which things they actually are reaching for the most and delivering impact is going to be the way to assess on a regular basis which ones you want to do. And you, it might help to make a pick a cadence as well for evaluating these things. There's just too much going on to be doing this all the time. So even if you might feel like I've got too much going on, or my team's you know, got too much software, to try to pick a cadence to assess that so that you're not kind of feeling that anxiety all the time and then just assessing on a regular basis.
I just wrote a 7-step process. Can I read it to you? Tell me.
Yeah,
if I'm
absolutely.
Right. I want to go and ride along. I want to get out in the field and I want to see what's really going on. I'm not just going to guess from my numbers in my office. I then want to observe. I'm not going to give my people feedback. I'm not going to try and improve that one individual. I'm just going to listen and take it all in. I'm going to be using time tracking to identify where is time actually being billed versus where is it not, and use that as a metric for myself. And really what I'm looking for is things that are highest time consumption but exist in almost every job that we do. I then want to look at my team and see what are they already excited about? What are they already trying to improve upon, and lean into those specific nuanced areas and find a champion that's either hired or exists in my company to be a big part of that with me. Once that all starts getting rolling, I will come back and assess it on a regular cadence to see how it's actually impacting. Is that a good summary of everything we just talked about?
That is a great summary. That's a very good summary. The only color I'd add to that is to add the bias for yourself, to blame the process first, and then to assess that as kind of your default position, especially when you're trying to design for improvement.
Okay. Blame the process first versus the person, or what do you mean by that?
So where you see waste or where you see inefficiency, to emphasize and bias towards, okay, is there a clear standard? Assuming that there's a clear standard for what the work was supposed to be, let's figure out how we can solve this from a tools, system, support right. perspective, as opposed to saying, is this, you know, so-and-so's fault.
We could just work smarter. We could hire better. We could, got it. Okay. That's good. Well, that was a complex episode that we just did, but I think for those who are trying to make change management happen, especially trying to just keep up with AI and some of the tools we need to do, hopefully this simplifies a few things. Anything else you want to give us advice on, just if, for those listening, where should we start? If someone's listening to this right now, depending if they're in electrical HVAC or, hey, they're doing window cleaning, but what could they take from today that would be tangible? Something they could take and go do?
Yeah, I think the easiest thing to do is just to, like we said, just to start, just get started, just to do that observation, to begin that process as you summarized. Try to pick a cadence to go do that, you know, once a month, once every couple months, once a week, whatever is sort of suitable for the time that you have, and then get rolling. If there's if folks have any questions about software or evaluating software, always happy to help. And I think you'll probably share contact information. Very happy to chat with folks to learn about what their challenges are and try to understand and offer some software specific advice, you know, from my background as to how to apply that to their business.
Yeah. And Mark, I mean, you run a company called Copperfield. You work with HVAC and electrical companies. You help clean up their processes through automation and AI. If you are that customer, we'll put a link down below. They can come check you out. And I think you should absolutely talk to you. You're a smart human, and we need more people like you in this industry. So thanks for coming in.
No, thank you. Really appreciate that. It's also great chatting with you, and I'm very excited to see where the industry goes. I think it's just a fantastic time to be building businesses.
It's a wild time, my friend. It's wild, wild west. Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our podcast, consider sharing this episode with another contractor that you think needs to hear it.